Penguin Random House Audio presents Adultery by Paulo Coelho, translated from the Portuguese by Margaret Yule Costa and Zoe Perry. Read for you by Susan Deniker. O Mary, conceived without sin, pray for those who turn to you. Amen. Put out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. Luke chapter 5, verse 4. Every morning when I open my eyes to the so-called new day, I feel like closing them again, staying in bed and not getting up. But I can't do that. I have a wonderful husband who is not only madly in love with me, but also the owner of a large investment fund. Every year, much to his distaste, he appears in Bilan magazine's list of the 300 richest people in Switzerland. I have two children who are, as my friends say, my reason for living. I get up early to make their breakfast and take them on the 5-minute walk to school where they spend all day, allowing me to work and fill my time. After school, a Filipino nanny looks after them until my husband and I get home. I enjoy my work. I'm a highly regarded journalist at a respectable newspaper that can be found in almost all the news kiosks in Geneva where we live. Once a year, I go on holiday with the whole family, usually to some far-flung paradise with marvelous beaches, where we stay in exotic cities inhabited by very poor people who make us feel richer, more privileged, and more grateful for the blessings life has bestowed upon us. Ah, but I haven't introduced myself. Pleased to meet you. My name's Linda. I'm in my 30s, 5'8", 150 pounds, and I wear the best clothes that money can buy, thanks to my husband's limitless generosity. I arouse desire in men and envy in other women. And yet, every morning, when I open my eyes to this ideal life that everyone dreams of having but few achieve, I know the day will be a disaster. Until the beginning of this year, I didn't question anything. I simply got on with my life, although now and then I did feel guilty about having more than I deserved. One day, though, while I was making everyone breakfast, it was spring, I remember, and the flowers were just beginning to open in the garden, I asked myself, "Is this it?" I shouldn't have asked that question. It was all the fault of a writer I'd interviewed the previous day who at one point said, "I haven't the slightest interest in being happy. I prefer to live life passionately, which is dangerous because you never know what might happen next." At the time, I thought, "Poor man. He's never satisfied. He'll die sad and embittered." The following day, I realized that I never take any risks at all. I know what lies ahead of me. Another day exactly like the previous one. And passion? Well, I love my husband, which means that I've no cause to get depressed over living with someone purely for the sake of his money, the children, or to keep up appearances. I live in the safest country in the world. I have no problems to speak of, and I'm a good wife and mother. I was brought up as a strict Protestant and intend to pass that education on to my children. I never take a false step because I know how easy it is to ruin everything. I do what I have to do efficiently and put as little of myself into it as possible. When I was younger, I experienced the pain of unrequited love, just like any other normal person. Since I married, though, time has stopped. Until, that is, I came across that horrible writer and his answer to my question. I mean, what's wrong with routine and boredom? To be honest, nothing at all. It's just the secret fear that everything could change from one moment to the next, catching me completely unawares. From the moment I had that ominous thought that bright, beautiful morning, I began to feel afraid. Would I be capable of facing the world alone if my husband died? Yes, I told myself, because the money he left behind would be enough to support several generations. And if I died, who would look after my children? My beloved husband. But he would surely remarry, because he's rich, charming, and intelligent. Would my children be in good hands? The first thing I did was try to answer all my questions. And the more questions I answered, the more questions appeared. Will he take a mistress when I get old? We don't make love as often as we used to. Does he already have someone else? Does he think I've found someone else because I haven't shown much interest in sex for the last 3 years? We never have jealous spats. And I used to think that was great. But after that spring morning, I began to suspect that perhaps our lack of jealousy meant a complete lack of love on both sides. I did my best not to think about the matter any more. For a whole week, whenever I left work, I would go and buy something in one of the expensive shops on Rue du Rhône. There was nothing I really wanted, but at least I felt that I was, how should I say this, changing something, discovering something I didn't even know I needed, like some new domestic appliance. Although it has to be said, novelties in the world of domestic appliances are few and far between. I avoided toy shops because I didn't want to spoil my children by giving them a present every day. I didn't go into any men's shops either, just in case my husband might grow suspicious of my sudden, extreme generosity. When I got home and entered the enchanted realm of my domestic world, everything would seem marvelous for a few hours, until everyone went to bed. Then, slowly, the nightmare would begin. I think that passion is strictly for the young. Presumably, its absence is normal at my age. But that isn't what terrifies me. Today, I am a woman torn between the terror that everything might change and the equal terror that everything might carry on exactly the same for the rest of my days. Some people say that as summer approaches, we start to have weird ideas. We feel smaller because we spend more time out in the open air, and that makes us aware of how large the world is. The horizon seems farther away, beyond the clouds and the walls of our house. That may be true, but I just can't sleep anymore, and it isn't because of the heat. When night comes and no one is watching, I feel afraid of everything. Life, death, love, or the lack of it. The fact that all novelties quickly become habits. The feeling that I'm wasting the best years of my life in a pattern that will be repeated over and over until I die. And sheer panic at facing the unknown, however exciting and adventurous that might be. Naturally, I seek consolation in other people's suffering. I turn on the TV and watch the news. I see endless reports about accidents, people made homeless by natural disasters, refugees. How many people on the planet are ill right now? How many, whether in silence or not, are suffering injustices and betrayals? How many poor people are there? How many unemployed or imprisoned? I change channels. I watch a soap or a movie, and for a few minutes or hours I forget everything. I'm terrified my husband might wake up and ask, "What's wrong, babe?" Because then I would have to say that everything's fine. It would be even worse if, as happened a few times last month, he put his hand on my thigh, slid it slowly upward, and started caressing me. I can fake orgasms. I often have. But I can't just decide to get wet with excitement. I would have to say that I'm really tired, and he, never for one moment admitting that he was annoyed, would give me a kiss, turn over, and watch the latest news on his tablet, waiting until the next day. And then I would hope against hope that when the next day comes, he'd be tired. Very tired. It's not always like that, though. Sometimes I have to take the initiative. If I reject him two nights in a row, he might go looking for a mistress, and I really don't want to lose him. If I masturbate beforehand, then I'm ready and everything's normal again. Normal means that nothing will ever be as it was in the days when we were still a mystery to each other. Keeping the same fire burning after 10 years of marriage seems a complete impossibility to me. And each time I fake an orgasm, I die a little inside. A little. I think I'm dying more quickly than I thought. My friends tell me how lucky I am, because I lie to them and tell them that we often make love, just as they lie to me when they say that they don't know how their husbands can still be so interested in sex. They say that sex in marriage is interesting only for the first 5 years, and after that calls for a little imagination. Closing your eyes and imagining your neighbor lying on top of you, doing things your husband would never dare to do. Imagining having sex with him and your husband at the same time. Imagining every possible perversion, every forbidden game. Today, when I leave the house to walk the kids to school, I take a good look at my neighbor. I've never imagined having sex with him. I'd rather imagine having sex with a young reporter who works with me, the one who seems to be in a permanent state of suffering and solitude. I've never seen him try to seduce anyone, and that's what's so charming. All the women in the office have commented that the poor thing needs someone to look after him. I reckon he knows this, and is happy merely to be an object of desire, nothing more. Perhaps, like me, he has a terrible fear of taking a false step and ruining everything, his job, his family, his past and future life. Anyway, I look at my neighbor this morning and feel like crying. He is washing his car, and I think, look at that. Another person just like me and my husband. One day we'll be doing the same thing. Our children will have grown up and moved to another city or even another country. We'll be retired, and we'll spend our time washing our cars, even if we can perfectly well afford to pay someone else to do it for us. After a certain age, you have to do irrelevant things, to pass the time, to show others that your body is still in working order, to express that you still appreciate the value of money and can still carry out certain humble tasks. A clean car won't exactly change the world. But this morning, it is the only thing my neighbor cares about. He says good morning, smiles, and goes back to his work as if he were polishing a Rodin sculpture. I leave my car at the park and ride. Take the bus into town. Say no to pollution. I catch the usual bus and look at the same things I always look at on the way into work. Geneva doesn't seem to have changed at all since I was a child. The grand old houses are still between the buildings put up by some mad mayor who discovered new architecture in the 1950s. I miss all of this when I travel. The appalling bad taste, the absence of huge glass and steel towers, the lack of highways, the tree roots that push through the concrete sidewalks and trip you up, the public parks with their mysterious little wooden fences overgrown with weeds because that's what nature is like. In short, a city that is different from others that have been modernized and lost their charm. Here we still say good morning when we meet a stranger in the street and goodbye when we leave a shop after buying a bottle of mineral water, even if we have no intention of ever going back. We still chat to strangers on the bus, even though the rest of the world thinks of the Swiss as being very discreet and reserved. How wrong they are! But it's good that other people should think of us like that. Because that way, we can preserve our way of life for another 5 or 6 centuries before the barbarians cross the Alps with their wonderful electronic gadgets, their apartments with tiny bedrooms and large living rooms to impress the guests, their women who wear too much makeup, their men who talk loudly and bother the neighbors, and their teenagers who dress rebelliously but who are secretly terrified of what their parents might think. Let them believe that all we produce is cheese, chocolate, cows, and cuckoo clocks. Let them believe that there's a bank on every corner in Geneva. We have no intention of changing that image. We're happy without the barbarian hordes. We're all armed to the teeth, since military service is obligatory. Every Swiss man has a rifle in his house. But you rarely hear of anyone shooting anyone else. We're pleased that we haven't changed for centuries. We feel proud to have remained neutral when Europe sent its sons off to fight senseless wars. We're glad not to have to explain Geneva's somewhat unattractive appearance with its fin de siècle cafés and elderly ladies strolling about the city. To say we're happy might not be entirely true. Everyone is happy, apart from me, as I travel to work, wondering what's wrong. Another day at the newspaper trying to ferret out some interesting news other than the usual car accident, weaponless mugging, and fire, which dozens of fire engines manned by highly qualified firemen rushed to put out and flooded an old apartment, all because the neighbors were alarmed about the smoke issuing from a pot roast left too long in the oven. Back home, there's the pleasure of cooking, the table set, and the family gathered around it, thanking God for the food we're about to receive. Another evening when, after supper, each person goes about his business, the father helping the children with their homework, the mother cleaning the kitchen, tidying the house, and putting out the money for the maid the next morning. There are times during these months when I feel really good, when I really believe that my life makes perfect sense, that this is the role of human beings on earth. The children feel that their mother is at peace, their father is kinder and more attentive, and the whole house seems to glow with its own light. We are an example of happiness to the rest of the street, the city, the canton, or what you might call the state, of the entire country. And then, suddenly, for no reason, I get into the shower and burst into tears. I can cry there because no one can hear my sobs or ask me the question I hate most. Are you all right? Yes, why shouldn't I be? Is there anything wrong with my life? No, nothing. Only the nights that fill me with dread. The days I can't get excited about. The happy images from the past and the things that could have been but weren't. The desire for adventure never fulfilled. The terror of not knowing what will happen to my children. Then my thoughts start to circle negative things, always the same, as if there were a devil watching from one corner of the room, ready to leap out and tell me that what I call happiness is merely a passing phase, that nothing lasts. Surely I know that. I want to change. I need to change. Today at work, I got ridiculously uptight, simply because an intern took longer than usual to find the material I wanted. I'm not normally like that, but I'm gradually losing touch with myself. It's silly to blame it all on that writer and his interview. That was months ago. He merely took the top off a volcano that could have erupted at any moment, sowing death and destruction around it. If it hadn't been him, it would have been a film, a book, or someone else I happened to talk to. I imagine that some people spend years allowing the pressure to build up inside them without even noticing. And then, one day, some tiny incident triggers a crisis. Then they say, "I've had enough. I don't want this anymore." Some commit suicide. Others get divorced. Some go to poor parts of Africa to try to save the world. But I know myself. I know that my only reaction will be to repress my feelings until a cancer starts eating me up inside. Because I do actually believe that many illnesses are the result of repressed emotions. I wake at 2 in the morning and lie staring up at the ceiling, something I've always hated, even though I know I have to get up early to go to work. Instead of coming up with a productive question like, "What's happening to me?" I let my thoughts spiral out of control. For days now, although not that many, thank God, I've been wondering if I should go to a psychiatrist and seek help. What stops me isn't my work or my husband, but my children. They couldn't understand what I'm feeling at all. Everything grows more intense. I think about a marriage, my marriage, in which jealousy plays no part. But we women have a sixth sense. Perhaps my husband has already met someone else, and I'm unconsciously responding to that. And yet, I have absolutely no reason to suspect him. Isn't this absurd? Can it be that of all the men in the world, I have married the only one who is absolutely perfect? He doesn't drink or go out at night, and he never spends a day alone with his friends. The family is his entire life. It would be a dream if it weren't a nightmare, because I have to reciprocate. Then I realize that words like optimism and hope, which appear in all those self-help books that claim they'll make us more confident and better able to cope with life, are just that, words. The wise people who pronounce them are perhaps looking for some meaning in their own life and using us as guinea pigs to see how we'll react to the stimulus. The fact is, I'm tired of having such a happy, perfect life. And that can only be a sign of mental illness. That's what I fall asleep thinking. Perhaps I really do have a serious problem. I have lunch with a friend. She suggests meeting at a Japanese restaurant I've never heard of, which is odd because I adore Japanese food. She assures me that it's an excellent place, although quite some way from where I work. It takes ages to get there. I have to take 2 buses and ask someone the way to the gallery, home to this supposedly excellent restaurant. I think the place is hideous. The decor, the paper tablecloths, the lack of any view. She's right, though. It's one of the best meals I've ever eaten in Geneva. I always used to eat in the same restaurant, which was okay, but nothing special, she says. Then a friend of mine who works at the Japanese consulate suggested this one. I thought it was pretty ghastly at first, as you probably did too, but it's the owners themselves who run the restaurant, and that makes all the difference. It occurs to me that I always go to the same restaurants and order the same dishes. I don't even take any risks in this. My friend is on antidepressants. That's the last thing I want to talk about, though, because I've come to the conclusion that I'm just a step away from sliding into depression, and I don't want to accept that. And precisely because it's the last thing I want to talk about, it's the very first subject I bring up. I ask how she's feeling. Much better, she says. Although the medication can take a while to work, once it kicks in, though, you regain your interest in life. Things get back their color and flavor. In other words, suffering has become yet another source of income for the pharmaceutical industry. Feeling sad? Take a pill and problem solved. I ask very gingerly if she would be interested in collaborating on a major article on depression for the newspaper. There's no point. Nowadays, people share their feelings on the internet. What do they discuss? The side effects of the different medications? No one's interested in other people's symptoms, because symptoms are infectious, and you'd suddenly start feeling things you didn't feel before. Is that all? No, there are meditation exercises too, but I don't think they're much use. I only started to get better once I accepted that I had a problem. But doesn't it help to know you're not alone? Isn't talking about depression's effects good for other people, too? No, not at all. If you've just emerged from hell, you don't want to know what life is like down there right now. Why did you put up with it for so many years? Because I didn't believe I could be depressed. And because whenever I talked about it with you or with other friends, everyone said it was nonsense, that people with real problems don't have time to feel depressed. It's true, that's exactly what I said. I insist, wouldn't an article or a blog help people to better cope with the illness and seek help? I'm not depressed myself, of course, and don't know how it feels. Could she tell me a bit about it? My friend hesitates, perhaps suspicious of my motives. It's like being inside a trap. You know you're caught, but you can't escape. That's exactly what I felt a few days ago. She starts listing a whole series of things that are apparently common to those who have visited what she calls hell. Not wanting to get out of bed, feeling that the simplest of tasks requires a Herculean effort. Being riddled with guilt because you have no reason to feel like this when there are so many people in the world who are really suffering. I try to concentrate on the excellent food, but it has already started to lose its flavor. My friend goes on. Apathy. Pretending to be happy, pretending to be sad, pretending to have an orgasm, pretending to be having fun, pretending that you've slept well, pretending that you're alive, until there comes a point where you reach an imaginary red line and realize that if you cross it, there will be no turning back. Then you stop complaining, because complaining means that you are at least still battling something. You accept the vegetative state and try to conceal it from everyone. And that's hard work. And what caused your depression? Nothing in particular. But why so many questions? Are you feeling depressed too? Of course not. Best to change the subject. We talk about the politician I'm going to interview in a couple days' time. He's an ex-boyfriend of mine from high school who probably doesn't even remember that we once exchanged a few kisses and that he touched my breasts. My friend is thrilled. I, on the other hand, try not to think about anything, keeping my reaction set to automatic. Apathy. I haven't yet reached that stage. I'm still at the complaining one. But I imagine that soon, in a matter of months, days, or hours, a complete lack of interest will set in that will be very hard to dispel. It feels like my soul is slowly leaving my body and heading off to an unknown place, some safe place, where it doesn't have to put up with me and my night terrors. It's as if I weren't sitting in an ugly Japanese restaurant with delicious food, experiencing everything as though it were just a scene in a film I'm watching, without wanting or being able to stop it. I wake up and perform the usual rituals, brushing my teeth, getting dressed for work, going into the children's bedroom to wake them up, making breakfast for everyone, smiling and saying how good life is. In every minute and gesture, I feel a weight I can't identify, like an animal who can't quite understand how it got caught in the trap. My food has no taste. My smile, on the other hand, grows even wider so that no one will suspect, and I swallow my desire to cry. The light outside seems gray. Yesterday's conversation did no good at all. I'm starting to think that I'm headed out of the indignant phase and straight into apathy. And does no one notice? Of course not. After all, I'm the last person in the world to admit that I need help. This is my problem. The volcano has exploded, and there's no way to put the lava back inside, plant some trees, mow the grass, and let the sheep out to graze. I don't deserve this. I've always tried to meet everyone's expectations. But now it's happened, and I can't do anything about it except take medication. Perhaps today I'll come up with an excuse to write an article about psychiatry and social security. The newspaper loves that kind of thing. And find a good psychiatrist to ask for help. I know that's not ethical, but then not everything is. I don't have an obsession to occupy my mind. For example, dieting, or being OCD and finding fault with the cleaning lady who arrives at 8 in the morning and leaves at 5 in the afternoon having washed and ironed the clothes and tidied the house, and sometimes having even done the shopping, too. I can't vent my frustrations by trying to be super mom, because my children would resent me for the rest of their lives. I go off to work, and again see the neighbor polishing his car. Wasn't he doing that yesterday? Unable to resist, I go over and ask him why.
It wasn't quite perfect, he says,
but only after having said good morning, asking about the family, and noticing what a pretty dress I'm wearing. I look at the car. It's an Audi. One of Geneva's nicknames is, after all, Audi Land. It looks perfect, but he shows me one or two places where it isn't as shiny as it should be. I draw out the conversation and end up asking what he thinks people are looking for in life.
Oh, that's easy enough. Being able to pay their bills, buying a house like yours or mine, having a garden full of trees, having your children or grandchildren over for Sunday lunch, traveling the world once you've retired.
Is that what people want from life? Is it really? There's something very wrong with this world, and it isn't just the wars going on in Asia or the Middle East. Before I go to the newspaper, I have to interview Jacob, my ex-boyfriend from high school. Not even that cheers me up. I really am losing interest in things. I listen to facts about government policy that I didn't even want to know. I ask a few awkward questions, which he deftly dodges. He's a year younger than me, but he looks 5 years older. I keep this thought to myself. Of course it's good to see him again, although he hasn't yet asked me what's happened in my life since we each went our own way after graduation. He's entirely focused on himself, his career, and his future, while I find myself staring foolishly back at the past, as if I were still the adolescent who, despite the braces on my teeth, was the envy of all the other girls. After a while, I stop listening and go on autopilot. Always the same script, the same promises, reducing taxes, combating crime, keeping the French, the so-called cross-border workers who are taking jobs that Swiss workers could fill, out. Year after year, the issues are the same and the problems continue unresolved because no one really cares. After 20 minutes of conversation, I start to wonder if my lack of interest is due to my strange state of mind. No, there is nothing more tedious than interviewing politicians. It would have been better if I'd been sent to cover some crime or another. Murderers are much more real. Compared to representatives of the people anywhere else on the planet, ours are the least interesting and the most insipid. No one wants to know about their private lives. Only two things create a scandal here: corruption and drugs. Then it takes on gigantic proportions and gets wall-to-wall coverage because there's absolutely nothing else of interest in the newspapers. Does anyone care if they have lovers, go to brothels, or come out as gay? No. They continue doing what they were elected to do, and as long as they don't blow the national budget, we all live in peace. The president of the country changes every year. Yes, every year. And is chosen not by the people, but by the Federal Council, a body comprising 7 ministers who serve as Switzerland's collective head of state. Every time I walk past the museum, I see endless posters calling for more plebiscites. The Swiss love to make decisions, The color of our trash bags, black, came out on top. The right, or not, to carry arms. Switzerland has one of the highest gun ownership rates in the world. The number of minarets that can be built in the country, 4. And whether or not to provide asylum for expatriates. I haven't kept pace with this one, but I imagine the law was approved and is already in force.
Excuse me, sir?
We've been interrupted once already. He politely asks his assistant to postpone his next appointment. My newspaper is the most important in French-speaking Switzerland, and this interview could prove crucial for the upcoming elections. He pretends to convince me, and I pretend to believe him. Then I get up, thank him, and say that I have all the material I need.
You don't need anything else?
Of course I do, but it's not up to me to tell him what.
How about getting together after work?
I explain that I have to pick up my children from school, hoping that he sees the large gold wedding ring on my finger, declaring, "Look, the past is the past."
Of course. Well, maybe we can have lunch some day.
I agree. Easily deceived, I think. Who knows? Maybe he does have something of importance to tell me. Some state secret that will change the politics of the country and make the editor look at me with new eyes. He goes over to the door, locks it, then comes back and kisses me. I return his kiss, because it's been a long time. Jacob, whom I may have once loved, is now a family man, married to a professor. And I am a family woman, married to a man who, though he inherited his wealth, is extremely hard-working. I consider pushing him away and saying that we're not kids anymore. But I'm enjoying it. Not only did I discover a new Japanese restaurant, I'm having a bit of illicit fun as well. I've managed to break the rules, and the world hasn't caved in on me. I haven't felt this happy in a long time. I feel better and better, braver, freer. Then I do something I've dreamed of doing since I was in school. Kneeling down, I unzip his fly and wrap my mouth around his penis. He grabs my hair and controls the rhythm of my head. He comes in less than a minute.
God, that was good.
I say nothing. The fact is that it was far better for me than for him, since he came so quickly. Sin is followed by a fear of being caught. On the way to the office, I buy a toothbrush and some toothpaste. Every half an hour or so, I go to the toilet to check that there's nothing on my face or on my Versace shirt, intricately embroidered and perfect for hiding stains. I observe my work colleagues out of the corner of my eye, but no one has noticed. Or at least none of the women, who have a special radar for these things. Why did that happen? It was as if someone else had taken over and propelled me into a situation that was purely mechanical and non-erotic. Did I want to prove to Jacob that I'm independent, free, my own woman? Did I do that in order to impress him? Or in an attempt to escape what my girlfriend called hell? Everything will continue as before. I'm not at any crossroads. I know where I'm going and hope that with the passing of the years, I'll manage to change my family's ways so that we don't end up thinking there's anything special about washing the car. The really big changes happen over time, and time is something of which I have plenty. At least I hope so. When I get home, I try to look neither happy nor sad. The children notice at once. You're acting funny today, Mom. I feel like saying, yes, I did something I shouldn't have done, and yet I don't feel the tiniest bit guilty, just afraid of being found out. My husband gets home, and as usual, he kisses me, asks what kind of day I've had, and what we're having for supper. I give him the usual answers. If he doesn't notice anything different about the routine, he won't suspect that today I gave oral sex to a politician, which, it should be said, gave me no physical pleasure at all. But now I'm mad with desire, needing a man, needing to be kissed, and needing to feel the pain and pleasure of a body on top of mine. When we go up to bed, I realize that I'm terribly aroused. I can't wait to make love with my husband, but I must keep calm. If I'm too eager, he'll suspect something is wrong. After I shower, I lie down beside him, take the tablet he's reading from his hands, and put it on the bedside table. I begin stroking his chest, and he immediately becomes aroused. We make love as we haven't done in a long time. When I moan a little too loudly, he asks me to keep the noise down so as not to wake the children. But I tell him I don't want to, that I want to be able to express my feelings. I have multiple orgasms. God, I love this man. We end up sweaty and exhausted, and so I decide to take another shower. He comes in with me and playfully turns the shower head on my clit. I ask him to stop, saying I'm too tired, that we need to sleep and he'll just get me all excited again. While we're drying each other off, I suggest going to a nightclub sometime, another attempt to change my routine at all costs. I think it's then that he suspects something has changed.
Tomorrow?
I can't tomorrow. I have my yoga class.
Since you've brought it up, can I ask a direct question?
My heart stops. He goes on.
Why exactly do you go to yoga classes? You're such a calm, well-balanced person, and a woman who knows what she wants. Aren't you wasting your time?
My heart starts beating again. I don't answer. I simply smile and stroke his face. I collapse onto the bed, close my eyes, and before I fall asleep, think, I must be having the kind of crisis that comes after 10 years of marriage. It'll pass. Not everyone needs to feel happy all the time. Besides, no one can be happy all the time. I need to learn to deal with the reality of life. Dear depression, please keep your distance. Don't be nasty. Find some other person with more reason than me to look in the mirror and say, what a pointless existence. Whether you like it or not, I know how to defeat you. You're wasting your time. My lunch with Jacob Koenig goes exactly as I imagine. We meet at La Perle du Lac, an expensive restaurant on the lake shore that used to be good, but is now owned by the city. It's still expensive, but the food is awful. I could have surprised him and taken him to the Japanese restaurant, but I know he would think it was in bad taste. For some people, decor matters more than food. And now I see that I made the right decision. He tries to show me that he's a wine connoisseur. He talks about bouquet, texture, and legs. the oily drops that fall in rivulets down the side of the glass. In truth, he's telling me that he's grown up and no longer a schoolboy, that he's learned how to behave and has risen in the world, that he knows about life, wine, politics, women, and ex-girlfriends. What nonsense. We've been drinking wine all our lives. We can tell a good wine from a bad one, and that's all there is to it. Until I met my husband, all the men I went out with, men who considered themselves cultivated, acted as if the choice of wine in a restaurant was their big moment. They all did the same thing. With great solemnity, they sniffed the cork, read the label, allowed the waiter to pour a little into the glass, turned it this way and that, held it up to the light, smelled the wine, rolled it around in their mouth, swallowed, and finally gave an approving nod. After witnessing the same scene endless times, I decided to change my group of friends and join the college's nerds and social outcasts. Unlike the fake, predictable tasters of wine, the nerds were at least real and made no attempt to impress me. They joked about things I didn't understand. They thought, for example, that I really ought to know the name Intel because it's written on every computer. I, of course, had never noticed. The nerds made me feel like a plain Jane ignoramus and were more interested in pirating things on the internet than they were in my breasts or legs. As I got older, I returned to the safe embrace of the wine tasters until I found a man who didn't try to impress me with his sophistication or make me feel like a complete idiot with conversations about mysterious planets, hobbits, or computer programs that erase all traces of the web pages you've visited. After a few months of going out, during which we discovered at least 120 villages around Lake Léman, he asked me to marry him. I accepted without hesitation. I asked Jacob if he knows any nightclubs because I haven't kept up with Geneva's nightlife, nightlife being just a manner of speaking, and I've decided to go out dancing and drinking. His eyes shine.
I don't have time for that. Thanks for the invitation, but, you know, apart from the fact that I'm married, I can't be seen out with a journalist. People would say your articles are...
biased.
Yes, biased.
I decide to take this little game of seduction a step further. It's a game that has always amused me. What have I got to lose? I know all the methods, diversions, traps, and objectives. I ask him to tell me more about himself, about his personal life. I'm not here as a journalist, I say, but as a woman and a former girlfriend. I stress the word woman.
I don't have a personal life, he says. I can't, unfortunately. I've chosen a career that has transformed me into an automaton. Everything I say is scrutinized, questioned, published.
This isn't quite true, but I find his sincerity disarming. I know that he's mostly seeing how the land lies, that he wants to know precisely where he's putting his feet and how far he can go. He suggests that he is unhappily married and goes into an exhaustive explanation of how powerful he is, just like all men of a certain age once they've hit the wine.
In the last 2 years, I've had a few months of happiness, a few of difficulties, but most are just a matter of hanging in there and trying to please everyone in order to be re-elected. I've had to give up everything that I used to enjoy, like going dancing with you, for example, or listening to music for hours, smoking or doing anything that other people deem to be wrong.
That's absurd.